it is gone. A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Swing and a miss. He got him. And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 346. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter, at John Stolness. Coming up, we're getting into a bunch of stuff. Even though the Phillies haven't made a whole lot of news, they did welcome their two new additions this week, Didi Gregorius and Zach Wheeler, officially to the team. So we'll talk a little bit about the news conference and some stuff that Matt Klentak had to say about what he thinks about the current roster and whether or not it's good enough to win the division in the National League East. And I'm going to be joined by my good buddy from The Good Fight, Paul Boyer. He's got some great stuff out right now about Zach Wheeler, about Didi Gregorius. We're going to get into some of his thoughts about what the Gregorius signing means for some of the younger players on the team. He's broken some of these guys down and done a phenomenal job for it. So make sure you're reading all of his stuff at The Good Fight. Make sure you're following him on Twitter at Paul_Boyer. Hey, Paul, thanks for coming back on Hittin' Season. How are you, my friend?
John, 346 speaks to me. It tells me that's the number of strikeouts Zach Wheeler is going to have this season. That's what I feel. That's what I'm sensing. I'm getting that cosmic energy, and I'm just putting it out there into the universe. How you doing, bud?
I'm good, pal. I'm here for 346 strikeouts. Ooh, buddy. That sounds pretty nice.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
Highly unlikely, but yeah. Pretty nice. I think the last Philly to get over 300, I think that was Curt Schilling.
You're probably right.
Yeah, I think it was like 97-ish, 98-ish, I think he had that many. But yeah, it's been a while. Most pitchers don't cross that threshold anymore. But Zach Wheeler, we're going to talk about Zach Wheeler up first here because you wrote a really good piece for The Good Fight about Zach Wheeler. Just talking about, because one of the reasons the Phillies went out and got Zach Wheeler and why they didn't spend, you know, 5 years and however $85 million on a guy like Madison Bumgarner and instead ponied up an extra $30 million over the course of the deal for Zach Wheeler is because they feel like Wheeler has more upside to him, that there's potentially more there than what we've seen so far. Because based on past history and based on the last couple of years, Bumgarner probably does make a little bit more sense than Zach Wheeler does. But Zach Wheeler's been solid the last couple of years. He's had really good stretches the last couple of years, but what the Phillies are banking on is that there's something extra. And they talked a lot about that at the news conference this week. So before I get into your piece for The Good Fight, one of the things that we talked about on the last episode of the podcast was, what would you rather have? Would you rather have Zach Wheeler at 118, or would you rather have Madison Bumgarner at $85 million, both five-year contracts, which if you could wave a magic wand and force either guy to be here, which of those deals would you rather have?
You know, it's interesting. I think over the life of these deals, that ends up being what, about $6 million annually in difference, roughly like one Tommy Hunter or something like that.
Yeah, it's about 3 years over $30 million over 5 years. So yeah, it's about $6 million.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the grand scheme of things for a baseball team, it's not the hugest difference in the world. But you look at it and it seems like, you know, $30 million, that's a huge difference. We really have to be sure we're getting it right if we're ponying up an extra $30 million. And you do. You always want to be right when you're throwing nine figures at somebody. But I look at these two players and, you know, let's assume for all things being equal for a second here, Madison Bumgarner would have played in any team or for any team that would have offered him the most amount of money and not locked in on Arizona. If we're thinking about these two guys, we have two really different careers, right? A lot is being made of Bumgarner's, I guess we'll call it usage, wear and tear. Maybe he's pitched a lot at the major league level for about 10 years now. Yeah. While Wheeler missed a bunch of time due to injury, but he doesn't have the competitive, you know, game innings total that Bumgarner has, not even close. And that's being painted as something of an upshot here, and I understand that. But also, Bumgarner has been there. And if you're a team that has all the numbers and can compute these things and you know, see if there's, you know, one thing that puts one guy farther ahead of another, that's great. In my eyes, they're both pretty similar pitchers, maybe not at the same points of their careers, but both guys that you want on a team that you have championship aspirations for. But if you want to win, I don't know. I feel the appeal now more than I have in past years toward that little intangible thing about a guy who's actually gone out there and done it. Now, granted, his greatest performance was 6 years ago at this point when he, rolled over the Royals in that World Series. But I like having that in my corner. That being said, I'm really just speaking up for a guy who I didn't really want in this scenario. I'm just trying to paint him in a brighter light. No, it's Zach Wheeler is the guy. Zach Wheeler is the guy. I buy into the fact that he's being pumped up as somebody who has yet to realize some stuff. Maybe I don't go quite as far as thinking he could make the Gerrit Cole leap. I could be talked into it, and I like thinking that way. It's sort of like when Joel Embiid was injured for the first couple of years of his pro career, and people were posting videos and they're like, oh, this guy could be something special. He could totally, change the way the NBA is played. And he's kind of had close to that impact. So if that's what we're looking at again, yeah, sure, fine. I can ride that hype train. I like that Wheeler throws hard because that's such a new thing for this staff. We're used to relievers throwing hard. We haven't had somebody like that in the rotation lately.
No. Do you remember the fanfare of when we got Vince Velasquez and his first few starts when he was throwing 96, 97 miles an hour? Everybody was just drooling all over themselves, super excited because for the first time in years, the Phillies had somebody that threw hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly right. And we can see there that that's a good example of somebody who has stuff, and I don't think any two pitchers are necessarily created equal, but we'll lump them into the same for this conversation here. It's a pitcher who has stuff that's not turning it into results. And you could argue that to a lesser degree, Wheeler has really, really great stuff that his stats have not measured up to. And that's something I was trying to figure out, well, why? Why is that happening? And that was the point of the piece that went up this week, and thank you for the kind words on that earlier. I looked at what he's done since he's returned from injury, so his last 3 years, and I noticed that he's making some adjustments and changing some things, but if we really want to go with this Gerrit Cole comparison, and we really think that because his stuff is about as hard and moves about as much as Cole's does, that there's a way to get him toward, the 14 strikeouts per nine and the two walks per nine and the ERA hovering around two with just the absolutely ridiculously unhittable stuff all the time, well, then we might as well try and mimic the guy who's doing all of that and see if it could actually work. So when I was looking at it, I saw one of the things that jumped out at me, and this came up in interviews, was that they wanted Wheeler to go up in the zone more with his fastball. And, compared to somebody like Cole, he was not doing it nearly as much. When he was going up there, he was being successful. He was limiting hitters to a really, really paltry, puny slugging percentage. It was under 300. But he wasn't going up there as much as somebody like Cole was. Cole was doing it about twice as often and still getting about the same results, even a little bit better. So you add in, 500 extra pitches that have suppressed slugging that much, and you can see why some of his numbers were so low.
Yeah.
You wonder, everything is in moderation, and I think that's the thing I struggle with a little bit here. You can say, okay, yes, this has worked, do it more, but everything has to be in a balance with a pitcher. You have to sequence these things right. If you have somebody like Wheeler, whose best pitch is arguably his curveball, that he only throws about 10% of the time, and you're like, well, just throw your best pitch all the time. Well, that's all hitters are going to sit on. Obviously, that's an extreme example, but that's why you have to balance these things. So I can sit back and say, okay, he throws really hard. Here's another pitcher who throws really hard with a fastball that moves about as much. He's going up in the zone a whole lot more. Well, why don't you follow his lead? I think it could work, but that's not necessarily a guarantee.
No, for sure. And this is kind of the conundrum the Phillies ran into with Nick Pivetta last year. They wanted Nick Pivetta to do a lot of the things that they were talking about with Gerrit Cole at the news conference. And, I think, maybe Cole's stuff, even though Wheeler has a fastball that can get up to 99 miles an hour, and he does have the great curveball, as you mentioned, maybe it is just a matter of increasing his pitch usage, of getting rid of the two-seamer, as he talked about, that he used his two-seamer a lot last year, even as he was making these changes, that just getting rid of that pitch entirely or almost entirely to focus on fastball, curveball, changeup, and be a three pitch guy, but locate. And we saw with Zach Wheeler. I was reading a piece in Fangraphs a couple weeks ago where they talked about some of the things that Wheeler does really well. He gets ahead of hitters. He manages to get to two strikes very quickly, but he leaves a lot of hittable fastballs over the middle of the plate with two strikes. And that I think was part of the problem with Nick Pivetta as well. And he started getting scared. And it was a matter of trying to locate that fastball. Some pitchers are able to put it right where they want it to be. Gerrit Cole can put it in that area. Because as you mentioned in your piece, there's a fine line between the top of the strike zone and out of the strike zone.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference because, you know, that slight difference can be the difference between getting a hitter to start to swing or a hitter to be able to say as it's leaving the pitcher's hand, no, that's out of the zone.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point with relation to Pivetta, everybody's, you know, favorite poster child of unrealized potential at this point.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just him, honestly. The Phillies staff as a whole got absolutely murdered with two strikes. I think they gave up some ridiculous number of two-strike homers that outpaced the league
or some franchise.
It was absolutely awful. And you can't have that when you get ahead of hitter. You cannot give those plate appearances back like that. That's just not that's not what you're supposed to do. And maybe it was 0-2 home runs. I don't have it in front of me. But if we have somebody like Wheeler who was doing that same thing, then you worry a little bit, right? And it increases the pressure on somebody like Brian Price, who has to come in and understand where the problems lay for this team last year. We're, you know, inheriting a lot of the same pitchers that were here last year. They have to be able to deploy their stuff in a way that's not throwing meatballs with two strikes. You know, if it's a full count, then you at least kind of understand it because you don't want to walk a guy. But if you have a guy behind 0-2, 1-2, even in a 2-2 count, and you end up throwing something down the chute, especially with the rabbit ball, you're going to get burned. And we saw that last year with this team. If you're going to have all of these hitters so easily park the ball, you can't serve it up on a tee for them. So we have to be able to find a way to dance around it a little bit more. I know it's so much easier said than done, and it's a matter of, you know, 3 inches here or there that could really make that difference. But it's a huge thing because we saw what could happen when this team leaves balls over the middle of the plate. They're going to get punished.
Right. But I think we see this is the formula, though. What they were talking about at the news conference is the formula. It's what worked for Steven Strasburg in the playoffs as well. I mean, Strasburg was doing it during the regular season more, and I think it's one of the reasons why he had the type of season that he had, that elevated fastball. We saw how often Houston and Nationals pitchers were using that weapon, and it's pretty simple. It's your fastball. It is the pitch you're supposed to be able to control a whole lot, you know, the easiest. But being able to put it at the top of the zone rather than in the middle of the plate, and because you linked a video of Wheeler leaving a pitch over the middle of the plate that got wobbled by, what was it, Juan Soto?
Juan Soto. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, it was hit to next year. So, I mean, it was and you know, all pitchers are going to get burned by that sort of thing, but that's what's interesting about the Wheeler signing is that he's got so many of the aspects that can make him better. And I think he's got better stuff than Nick Pivetta. I think he just has better pure stuff than Pivetta does,
I agree.
But you know, so there is that difference there. Pivetta has good stuff. I think Wheeler has very good stuff.
Yeah, I think having a little bit extra on the fastball plus having more snap with the curveball keep Wheeler separate. The fact that he can maintain 98 later into a game, the fact that he has a curve and a slider really too, that he can throw both to lefties and to righties, that he has a changeup that he can use against lefties, that he doesn't use so much when he's ahead. That's not really a put away pitch for him. But the fact that he has it and he has a weapon to use against lefties, that's something we've been looking for out of Pivetta for a long time. He doesn't. Yeah. He flirted with the idea of some kind of a changeup or a split finger or whatever it was, and it hasn't worked. And I think that's one of the things that's held him back. So Wheeler definitely has a step ahead of him in that department.
So what's your confidence level in Brian Price being able to help Wheeler make these changes? Because I think that is a big key here. If it was Chris Young, I would have absolutely no confidence in the previous regime getting them to make these changes. But with a new voice in there and a guy with a track record, I wonder what your thoughts are on how confident you are in this actually working.
You know, we'll call it the clean slate phenomenon. I feel great about it because I have no reference for failure, right? I'll print out a picture of Johnny Cueto and hang it over a shrine and say a prayer to it every day and hope that Price can come in and do for guys like Wheeler and even Pivetta and Velasquez what he was able to do for Johnny Cueto with Cincinnati. I mean, why not? There's no reason for me not to hope that he can do this sort of thing.
Let's talk about Didi Gregorius, the other guy who was at the news conference. And I think, you know, no matter, putting his stuff on the field aside, it looks like he's a fun player to watch. I think this guy's going to be, he's going to be a fun guy to have on the team. It sounds like, from everything I've read, that he's a great presence in the clubhouse, which is important for this team. I think Bryce Harper and JT Realmuto certainly added an air of professionalism. But having Andrew McCutchen around the whole season this year hopefully will go a long way, and putting Didi Gregorius in the mix will also add to some clubhouse chemistry, hopefully. And, you know, that'll be good. You know, that stuff's important. But what we're all needing is for Didi Gregorius to actually get back to the way he was from 2016 to 2018. Last year was obviously a down year for Gregorius. He missed half the season recovering from Tommy John surgery, an unusual injury for a shortstop. And from everything he seemed to be saying at the news conference, he rushed back from the Tommy John surgery. He wanted to get back on the field and you know, help the Yankees win the pennant. And so you wonder, you know, that definitely affected his market, that affected his play, and he signed a one-year prove-it deal. But I do, Paul, like the fact that they got a guy on a one-year prove-it deal. We saw Josh Donaldson and Mike Moustakas last year really play well on these one-year prove-it deals because they wanted to get that multi-year contract. They did so. And I know the Phillies, that's what they're hoping for with Didi Gregorius here, that he's going to stay healthy and that he's motivated. These guys on one-year deals, they turn out pretty motivated here. So I think that's a reason for optimism. I know you wrote about Didi Gregorius in the days after they signed him. What's your take on the Didi signing so far?
You know, I like it. I think it was a strange kind of confluence of emotions when they signed him because, you know, Anthony Rendon was still available at that time. Josh Donaldson, as of, you know, our conversation right now, is still available too. And so you look at the left side of the infield and you realize that the Phillies had open spots there, plural,
yeah,
considering that, you know, what turned out to be true was that they were thinking of moving Gene Segura off of shortstop. And you look at Gregorius and you're like, okay, here's a guy who obviously found success in Yankee Stadium, where left-handed hitters tend to find success these days. And he's a nice player. I have absolutely no problem with this contract. I think, just like you were saying, a one-year deal is great. It's really hard to find fault with just about any one-year major league deal you could hand out to anybody just because it's so short-term. You're not carrying a long-term risk. You're not carving up future payroll for guys who could flame out. If this just so happens that it ends badly, okay, it's 1 year, fine, $14 million. They spent $17 million on Jeremy Hellickson. How'd that go? So
right.
I think it's fine. I like the guy a lot. As a player, he's fine. He's not my ideal kind of player, I guess, because I'm so fixated on the kinds of guys who will just grind out at bats, you know, time after time they're up the plate. I think Bryce Harper is the ideal kind of player. And every player can't be Bryce Harper.
Right.
But for a shortstop, having a left-handed hitter with a bit of a power stroke and a little bit of aggression, I think, could be interesting with this lineup.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem like the kind of guy you want to bat second, certainly not third, and especially not with the other guys in this lineup right now. Mm-hmm. But if you bat him fifth or sixth, assuming, you know, the on-base guys like Harper and Hoskins are getting on ahead of him, well, then you got a guy who's going to put the ball in play. And as we all know, putting the ball in play is... things can happen. Things can happen. You know, it's not an automatic out when you put the ball in play. I like that he still has range. I like that his throwing arm didn't really seem to be heavily affected by recovering from Tommy John surgery, which is always a little bit of a concern when somebody's throwing arm has to go under the knife, even if they're not a pitcher. And I think he's a good add. You know, absent adding one of the true huge earth shakers like Rendon or even a Donaldson, this was about what you wanted the team to do.
Yeah.
I wanted them to go harder after the big guys.
Yeah, really so did I. Yep.
I think adding another impact guy, you can't do this every year. I get it. You know, we are only a year after Harper, and we do have the Realmuto Bucks coming up after spring training probably. And you can't do this every year. I get it. Teams can't be the mid to late 90s Yankees anymore. But at the same time, these are really high impact guys, and you only have so long of a competitive window before these things start to shut. And Didi Gregorius, bless his heart, is not Anthony Rendon or Josh Donaldson. That being said, I like that it frees things up a little bit, but it still has me a little bit worried about Gene Segura. That's nothing to do with Didi. I think Didi, the player, is fine. He's going to be a great fit here. He's going to inject a lot of fun into the clubhouse, and I think the fans are really going to like him. Even if he doesn't necessarily perform all that well, as long as the team keeps in the hunt, stays competitive, stays in there, I think he's one of those guys who would really fit in well and win over a lot of hearts and minds, which is great. You know, we're notoriously tough to win over, and even then, I think this is the right mix of talent and personality that can thrive, even if it's only for a one-year deal.
Yeah, and I think as far as the lineup goes, I was thinking about where to put him because you're right, he's not a two-hole hitter, and I think you kind of want to go lefty-righty as much as you can with baseball. I think it looks like they're going to implement the three-hitter rule for relief pitchers, so I think that's going to add a little bit more significance now. And so to me, I think you put McCutchen at number one, and then I'm probably batting Gene Segura at number two in the hopes that he can kind of return to being the on-base guy. Although, you know what? I think I go McCutchen one. I think I probably go Bryce Harper two. I probably go JT Realmuto three. And you know what? I probably bat Didi Gregorius in the four hole. If you think those three guys are going to get on in front of him, I want a guy who's up there looking to get aggressive. And then you've got a guy in Rhys Hoskins hitting number five behind them who can kind of be a little bit more patient at the plate, but hopefully is takes more advantage than he did last year of RBI opportunities. I think that's how I'm putting together the top. And then you put Gene Segura, I think, in slotted behind Rhys Hoskins in the six hole, and then it kind of work your way down. I'm trying to remember who else it is. I'm forgetting, and that's
Kingreen Haseley.
Yeah, so Kingreen Haseley, I think I'm at 7 and 8. You know
that's really not bad, and I think that's interesting. We're probably going to see at some point. We're probably going to see Gregorius batting fourth. One of the big points that you mentioned was that three batter rule, and it really is going to be important to have lineup spacing. You know, I found myself when this rule was announced as being implemented for this season, I found myself thinking back to the Chase Utley, Ryan Howard, Raul Ibanez days, and thinking how crazy that was even for that time. And now, even with this change, there's no way that anybody would do that anymore. I can't think of the last time I saw a Phillies lineup stack three left-handed hitters since he left. And that's not really relevant to what's going on now. It made me chuckle and brought up a neat little memory.
Yeah.
It's going to be really important to have these guys spaced out. And I think a lot depends on where you put Harper. If you bat Harper second, yeah, absolutely. That opens up cleanup for Gregorius. If you bat him third, well, then you need to consider if Hoskins is batting second, which I go back and forth on.
Yeah, I don't love that.
Or fourth, maybe fifth, if you got JT. There are options, and I think that's a good problem to have.
Well, let's step away and take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about another piece that you wrote for The Good Fight this week, where you talked a little bit about how the Gregorius signing affects a couple of the two younger position players that the Phillies are going to be running out there next year. And talk about Matt Klentak's comments that the Phillies are good enough to win the National League East. We'll discuss whether or not that's actually true or not. That's up next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. So me chatting with Paul Boyer here from The Good Fight. Again, follow Paul on Twitter at Paul_Boyer. Lots of good stuff from Paul last couple weeks here on The Good Fight, analyzing some of the big moves the Phillies have made. Before we get into the Gregorius thing with Alec Bohm and Adam Haseley, do you think that they're done? Do you think that they're pretty much done going after the big fish? What are the chances you think they go over the luxury tax at some point this offseason?
I think they are done going after the really big fish. I don't see them being players for even the Hyunjin Ryus, the Dallas Keuchels. I think they've made their bed, and they're going to go with the options that they have in-house for the rotation right now. I think if there's, again, I'm going mostly on hunch at this point, I think if there's any fire to the smoke, it's probably for a reliever. I like the fact that they were linked to Dellin Betances. I think that's a really nice player. That's a guy I'd like to have on this team. There's some concern about whether going over the tax for just that one more ad and setting yourself up to be over for a second consecutive year when you go into the free agent pool again next offseason, there's a debate over whether that's really the best approach to take. And I get it. I just think that if you have an opportunity to add a talented player, you should.
Yeah.
And then you figure it out later.
Right.
That being said, I don't think they're going to make any really huge additions unless somebody falls into their lap on a ridiculous deal. I don't know.
This doesn't seem like the offseason where that's going to happen.
No.
I mean, in past off seasons, yeah, I could see that possibly happening. But the way guys are flying off the shelves and the way teams are spending, they're overspending for players this offseason, which mm-hmm. is weird, Paul, because it's this offseason is so much different than the last two off seasons. Is it really the presence of two big name starting pitchers that has caused everybody to go crazy? What is in the water this off season as compared to the last two off seasons when we had people talking about collusion?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what separates Gerrit Cole and Anthony Rendon from Manny Machado and Bryce Harper of a year ago. I mean, we have an additional year of knowledge on those latter two now that might color that conversation a little bit differently, especially with Machado. But I'm not sure why it took so long for those two to get the deals they did, while it was nearly immediate that the two best free agents were off the board this offseason, at least by the winter meetings. And it was done. It didn't stretch out until February or March. It was done.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if it's maybe it's teams being anxious with the looming labor conflict coming up at the end of the 2021 season, where they think, well, now we got to, our windows are open now. It's only the next two seasons. We'll have to worry about the rest of these contracts when we finish labor negotiations. Who knows what the landscape of the sport is going to look like at that point? Maybe teams were a little less content to sit back on their hands and wait these guys out, knowing that they may only have 2 years of these contracts to worry about anyway, which is a scary thought and probably a discussion for another time. But apart from that, I don't really know what else would have changed. It's kind of like comparing apples to oranges, but I don't really know why it's such a drastic change when the level of talent is, you know, at the very least comparable.
Yeah. No, I mean, the starting pitchers, the two top starting pitchers were certainly worth going after, and starting pitching obviously is a more desirable commodity than position players, but it's some of the lower rung guys, you know, the guys who, you know, you wouldn't have expected. You know, Madison Bumgarner got 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's amazing. Like it's a very similar type profile to Jake Arrieta, who couldn't get more than 3 years from the Phillies a couple of years ago. It's interesting. And the fact that Bumgarner, I think it seems like from everything I was reading on Wednesday night here, that he turned down other bigger offers because he wanted to go play in Arizona so that he could be close to his horse. You know, I mean, that's really what it came down to. He targeted Arizona and for a little less money because he really wanted to play there.
So. Whatever works, man. Whatever
yeah,
works.
Man, it's your free agency. You want to go someplace, you know, for your horses. I'm not going to yell at you about it. That's fine with me. Let's talk about the Alec Bohm and Adam Haseley piece that you wrote. And it was another really good piece, Paul, because these two guys are kind of linked together. And both of these guys, their future could very much have been in doubt, especially in 2020, if they had gone out and gotten Anthony Rendon or Josh Donaldson. And again, as we're recording this, it certainly is possible the Phillies could go get Josh Donaldson, but highly unlikely.
Yeah.
But with Gregorius in the fold, it allows the Phillies to continue to leave space open for both of these guys, because with Alec Bohm, it doesn't make you sign a third, you know, you didn't sign a third baseman to a 4 or a 5 year contract. If they had done that, then you got to make a decision with Alec Bohm, probably this offseason or this coming summer. With Adam Haseley, the fact that you didn't, you know, that Scott Kingery is going to take over likely at third base, that means he's not going to be playing much center field, which gives Adam Haseley a lot of opportunities. So talk a little bit about these two young guys and what Gregorius' signing does for their future here in 2020 and long term.
It's such an interesting situation that a looming decision at third base also impacts center field. You know, even with this era of players playing so many different positions and versatility, you don't often hear about those two positions being linked. But that's the fact of the matter right now. The fact of the matter is that the Phillies see Alec Bohm as a third baseman, at least in the short term. There's no room at first base. That's where Rhys Hoskins is. You know, slump and all, that's his position for this year. And all of the other corners are taken up. Gregorius is playing shortstop. Gene Segura, that move, the trade to pick him up in the fallout from thinking Hoskins can play left field and signing Santana to play first base, that's something we might be feeling for a while.
Yeah.
But the fact that he can at least still play second base and should probably be pretty good at it is fine, and can it, you know, it can push this conversation to the back burner for a day. But you think about Kingery and Haseley, and they are the two players who are most likely to split time in center field. Maybe you see a little bit of Roman Quinn here and there if he's healthy. But right now you figure that when Boehm is ready, and third base is the only reasonable position that would be available to him when he's ready to come up, that would bump Kingery out to center field. And I don't know what the playing time looks like once that happens. Unless they feel like benching Gene Segura, which I really don't think they'll do with as much money and time as he has left on his deal. And so you have this interesting little domino effect where the super utility player, if you're trying to keep getting him regular at bats, may force his way into some kind of strange platoon situation if both coexist. But even then, Kingery plays the weak side platoon. You know, he's right-handed, and if you want to get him more at-bats, you want him facing right-handers too. So then what do you do with Haseley? Do you turn him into a fourth outfielder and defensive guy when he was showing so much promise, well, enough promise at least to warrant a more extended look as a center fielder? It's a really strange thing that's brewing and coming to the surface, and I think a lot, whether it's fair or not, a lot is going to depend on how all of these guys perform early in the season. From Boehm to Kingery to Segura to Haseley, all of them. Boehm on whether he gets promoted, you know, whether he hits well enough to actually get promoted. Kingery and Segura, I guess to a lesser extent, and also Haseley, if they perform well enough to stay in the lineup. If they're not hitting, well, there's your justification for benching one of them if Boehm's ready to come up and slotting the other guy in to take his place. It's going to be a strange shuffling of the deck. I don't really know what it's going to look like. My first instinct is to think that Haseley might get sent down, or, you know, maybe by that time Roman Quinn is injured and there's still a spot for him on the roster. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm really going to be fascinated to see what this is going to look like if, say, by mid-May, Boehm is knocking on the door and the Phillies don't really have a choice but to promote him.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I liked what I saw from Adam Haseley last year. I thought the defense that he provided was good enough to make him your everyday starting center fielder. You should have enough offense elsewhere in this lineup that you don't need Adam Haseley to hit 280 for you, you know, to have a 350 on base percentage. Those things would be nice. I certainly wouldn't turn them away. But if he can give you, I'm going to ask you, what's a competent slash line for Adam Haseley, provided he gives you the kind of defense that we saw from him last year?
Yeah, I'm in your camp there. I think if he hits somewhere in the 250s with a 310, 320 on base, I'd like to see a low 400 slugging, especially if the rabbit ball stays in play. I think if you have the kind of defense we saw in center field from him with a 725 to 750 OPS, that's fine. I can live with that. It's not great. It probably wouldn't, you know, crack 100 on the OPS plus. But again, if you have that kind of defense out there, if what we saw from him was real, then chances are he's making up for it with his glove. And like you said, we don't need to have Kenny Lofton out there.
Right. Right, and he's probably, you know, you're probably looking at with the slash line you mentioned and plus defense, you're probably looking at a 3-win player that way. I mean, that's essentially what Scott Kingery was last year, right? I mean, a 3-win player. I mean, if you can get, and, you know, that's kind of what I want to move into now is talking about Matt Klentak's comments that the Phillies are good enough to win the National League East. He said as much at the news conference when they were introducing Didi and Zach this week, and you know, I think at this point it looks like either the Nationals or Braves will get Josh Donaldson. It'll probably be one of those teams sounding more like the Nationals than the Braves, and then it'll be interesting to see what the Braves do to fill that hole in their lineup. But regardless, you know, just looking at what the Phillies have done, look at their win total from last year. They won 81 games. Their Pythagorean win-loss record was 79 wins. So they're a 79-81 win team at this point, you know, at the end of last year. Have they done enough? Is adding Zach Wheeler to essentially replace Vince Velasquez in the starting rotation? Let's say that Velasquez is the odd man out. Is swapping those two guys enough? And you've essentially swapped Cesar Hernandez for Didi Gregorius, and you're replacing Michael Franco with Scott Kingery at third base. So these are the main additions that you're making to your everyday core, your everyday lineup. And then I don't know what the hell is going to go on with the bullpen. The bullpen is just going to be what it's going to be. I'm fine with them not spending big money. I'd love to see them get somebody like Dellin Betances, but I could understand the reluctance, especially if he's going to cost $10 million. You don't go over the tax for Dellin Betances. You go over that. I mean, do it. If you want to get him, do it. But then go get lots of other guys. If you're going to go over the tax and go over, right? But, you know, at this point, the additions that the Phillies have made, adding Wheeler, adding Gregorius, moving out Franco and putting Kingery at third base, making Adam Haseley your starting center fielder, is that enough? Is this team good enough to win the National League East?
On its own, no. But I say that with the very quick follow-up that this team is better on paper than it was last year. I've said a couple times on, you know, a couple of different episodes with you, John, that I think hope as a strategy is a bad idea. Yep. And a lot of this team's success, again, is based on hope. And, you know, every team has a little bit of this at least, but it always feels like, at least lately, a disproportionate amount of the Phillies' strategy is based on hope. In this case, we are hoping that Zach Wheeler finds a little bit extra and is, you know, a true number two, or maybe this 1A that they call him. We are hoping that Didi Gregorius is recovered enough from his injury that last year was kind of an aberration and that he returns to more 17-18. We are hoping that a number of these injured bullpen guys, David Robertson aside, and guys who regressed a little bit, rebound or find some new life with Brian Price, that they end up turning into a more reliable unit. There's a lot that's still unanswered about this team, even though they did get better. The moves they made and the ones you just outlined absolutely make this a better team. Not by, you know, three leaps and bounds, but I think enough to say, yeah, okay, we've probably fielded another high 80s win team. I mean, maybe 87-75 if we want to put a number to it. But the fact of the matter is that they were already playing catch up to the Nationals and the Braves. If the Nationals add Josh Donaldson to replace Anthony Rendon, and they've, you know, still got those, you know, three horsemen of the apocalypse at the front of their rotation, even with their own bullpen troubles, they're still a force to be reckoned with. And the Braves are still a gigantic pain in the butt, and they're not going anywhere anytime soon, especially if some of their young pitchers take the next step, you know, like a Bryce Wilson or a Kyle Wright, or, you know, these guys come out and emerge a little bit more, then we're really in trouble. So that's why on its own, yes, the Phillies did get a little bit better. But they had so much to catch up to anyway that I don't think they quite did it. And they're going to need a little bit of help from those other teams. Other guys need to regress. Maybe you don't root for this, but maybe somebody gets hurt and misses an extended amount of time that could bring them back to the pack a little bit. On paper, no, it doesn't seem like the Phillies are better than third place right now.
Which is really hard to wrap your mind around, and I think you have to question the roster construction. And I mean, Matt Klentak has been aggressive, and you can't say that this team hasn't spent money and that this team hasn't done anything over the last couple of years. They've clearly invested in this roster. I mean, when they're going to have probably a top five payroll in baseball in 2020. They're right at the luxury tax. When you've got a payroll over $200 million, you should be better than an 87 to 88 win team, you know?
Think,
I mean,
right?
And so that falls on the general manager. I mean, that doesn't speak well for Matt Klentak and how he's put this team together. And maybe some of this is bad luck. Maybe Gabe Kapler and the previous coaching staff was a real hindrance and prevented this team from winning some ball games. Maybe bringing Joe Girardi on board is worth a couple of extra wins but again, that's, you're talking about hope as a tactic and hoping that these changes that you have made. I think what the Phillies are banking on is, yes, we've added these two new players, but they're really banking on the new manager helping them broach the gap here a little bit in 2020.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for overhauling the coaching staff the way they have, and they get some leeway. But again, we're, you know, starting over with a clean slate in the middle of this competitive window for what feels like the second or third time already. And at some point, you have to stop doing that. I honestly don't know how much I can lay directly at Klentak's feet, because I see problems in some of the things he's done while also seeing the upside to some things he's done. He has made some good moves. you know, things that were good process and ended up with bad results, you know, like plucking Charlie Morton just at the start of his metamorphosis, only to have him blow his ACL out. Who knows what that could have turned into? And that's just one example. But I look at this team's inability to create, let's call it a pipeline, right? They haven't been able to create an effective pipeline of helping these younger, you know, high school, really raw guys, and sometimes even the college age guys, navigate their way from the low minors to the upper minors and eventually make that successful leap to the major leagues. Something has been getting lost between Clearwater and Reading and Lehigh Valley, much less Philadelphia itself. The developmental successes have been fewer and further between than you'd really want, especially if, you know, if you're really going to treat the competitive tax levels as some kind of cap, then you need to be able to pump out guys who are not making $13, $14, $20, $25 million a year and have them perform. I think they should be paying more anyway, just because if you own a major sports franchise, you should be paying this money, blah, blah, blah. Different discussion. If you're going to be treating these things as hard levels, you need to have that support system. They have not been getting that. You kind of hoped that Michael Franco was going to do that. You know, when he was cost controlled and making minimum or just above, he had half of a breakout season and then never got anywhere. You can go all the way back to Dominic Brown under a different development regime where he sputtered and flamed out after one good season. They just have a history of these guys, or in some cases, it's only one guy we're talking about in a given year, and we have to pin all of our hope of a homegrown guy, and this is the guy who's going to help the big league team. It's always one guy. It never feels like multiple guys are on their way. It feels like we're always looking at one. Hell, I feel like it's a bonus just to have Spencer Howard and Alec Bohm in the same conversation. That's two guys. It's one hitter and one pitcher, you know?
One of the most fun seasons of the decade for me was 2017. They weren't a winning team in 2017, but in the second half, it actually felt like they had more than one guy. It felt like Aaron Altair was playing really well, but Altair had a great season in 2017 when he could stay on the field. He just was hurt a little bit, but was looking like a piece to build around. Nick Williams came up to the majors and was a productive player and an exciting guy to think about that maybe you can build around him. You had Jorge Alfaro, who looked like he had all the talent in the world, and you didn't know exactly what you were going to get out of him, but, you know, you had a reason to be kind of hopeful there. Rhys Hoskins came up and went on that homer binge, and you had Scott Kingery raking like crazy in AAA, and then they signed him to a major league deal in spring training of 2018. You had all those different guys, and J.P. Crawford, who was one of the top prospects in baseball, and who had struggled in the minors, but you thought, okay, at some point he's going to turn it around. He's got this great defensive skill. None of those guys panned out. I mean, we can't say for sure Hoskins and Kingery haven't panned out. Right. Kingery was a three-win player last year, and Hoskins was about the same 2.5 to a three-win player. But nobody's confident that Rhys Hoskins is going to be the player we were hoping he was going to be. Nobody knows for sure if Scott Kingery is going to be a really productive major league player, And those are the only two guys right now. I mean, Haseley out in center field was never a top prospect, even though he was a first-round draft pick. Same thing. Now, Alec Bohm, maybe, but he hasn't played AAA yet. Mm-hmm. And I get why the Phillies are trying to create a space for him, and I'm fine with that. I'm in favor. You know, if you want to say we believe in this kid, we think he's going to be he's going to be a major part of the team moving forward, then great. But, you know, you're right. It's not since 2017. So many of those guys just didn't pan out, and is that talent, or is that an inability by the coaching staff to get the most out of these young guys?
Man, I don't know, and that's what's so frustrating about it. It's good that you brought up the 2017 team, because I think that does poke a little bit of a hole in my hyperbolic rant a second ago, where there were, you know, obviously more than one guy that you could look to and say, oh, okay, maybe he's going to be interesting. But then you look at every one of them, and they all have their warts. Like, they've all started to rust around the edges a little bit. Hoskins had a three-month slump. Kingery started out blazing hot, then got hurt and wasn't really the same guy afterward. Nick Williams, who the hell knows what's going to happen with Nick Williams anymore? My God.
He's still on the team. Yeah. I keep forgetting. He's still on the team.
Yeah, we never talk about him. There are fits and starts across the board where you can see the promise and you can see why the talent evaluators in this organization really like some of these guys. And I get it. I feel like I can sometimes see what they see. But it hasn't translated into working into you know, something like you point toward the Cardinals, you know, as you hold them up as this, you know, huge shining success of a player development system. And I guess now that that torch has sort of been passed over to the Braves with the number of guys they keep cranking out anymore. And the Phillies just have not been able to keep up. The guys that they have graduated haven't turned into these consistent performers that you'd hope they would yet. And yeah. You're right. It's still too early to write some of these guys off. Absolutely. But if they're going to take that next step, if they're going to finally get back to the playoffs, they need help from within, because they can't keep buying guys as much as I think they should throw their money around and light it on fire.
Yeah.
You can't keep doing that. You need the help from the internals, and they haven't been getting that, at least not consistently yet.
We'll see if Adam Haseley, Rhys Hoskins, Scott Kingery can improve and take a big step forward. That's one of the things Matt Klentak is hoping here in 2020. And we'll see if Alec Bohm at some point gets up to the major leagues as well. Folks, if you have not been reading Paul Boyer's stuff at The Good Fight, make sure that you are doing it and follow him on Twitter at Paul_Boyer. Paul, thanks so much for coming back on Hittin' Season. It's always a pleasure, my friend.
Johnny, happy holidays to you and yours, my man. Thanks so much.
Back at you. All right, we'll finish up with our stat of the week, and this comes courtesy of the very same Mr. Paul_Boyer. He had this on Twitter earlier this week. A Didi Gregorius stat. Didi Gregorius had one strikeout looking in 344 plate appearances last season. That's kind of weird. In fact, he's the only player to have 300 or more plate appearances in a season and strikeout looking one or zero times since Kenji Yohima for Seattle in 2008. Folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. Again, my thanks to Paul for coming on the podcast. If you haven't done so, folks, make sure that you leave a rating and a review at the Apple Podcasts for the Good Fight podcast feed. And check out our Patreon. We got lots of good bonus stuff up there right now. New podcasts, new written content, some video stuff up as well. It's at patreon.com/hittinseason. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.